accession number 23378, reel 14.
This is the seventh reel of a taped interview with Bill Roden in his home in Melbourne, Victoria, on the 16th of the 5th, 2002, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. You wanted to talk about your return back to Australia, and as I understand, something that would end up being quite a lengthy time in Australia for you.
In memory, I think our leave was about a fortnight. That would be all. It was a march through Melbourne.
Tell us about that.
Oh, high excitement. Took place at lunchtime on one day, and great emotion. Crowds turned out cheering and home the conquering heroes come. The fact of the 7th Division, the silent 7th, was aired in the newspapers and radio stations. Or wireless, as they called it in those days. And it was quite an occasion. Stories of exploits were written up by newspapers. Almost immediately after the march was over, we were back into quarters and off again to Queensland. But it was a great period of leave. Pat and I, having been married early in mid-1943, she got hold of a little flat which had been vacated by one of her cousins, and subsequently we got another flat in Jolimont near the Melbourne Cricket Ground. We played golf and I got malaria. It was a crowded period. It was great.
There was a story that you related before about the marriage to Pat. Tell us about that, how that came about.
At that stage I was up in the Tenterfield commanding the training brigade. It's a training battalion. And the brigadier of the brigade, not having met me, called me up one evening for a drink. We got chatting about this, that and the other thing, our respective areas of previous service. He'd been in England with the contingent that went there at the beginning of the war, subsequently sent back to the Middle East and to Tobruk. I told him where I'd been, and we got talking then about my private life. I told him that I'd just been admitted to practice as a barrister and solicitor of the Supreme Court of Victoria just prior to joining up. And he said, "Are you married?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "You got a girlfriend?" I said, "Yes." He said, "How long have you been out?" I said, "Oh, forever." He said, "How would a bit of leave suit you to go and get married? A week starting on Sunday. That'll be fine. Thank you very much." I sent a telegram, as is the way of communication in those days, not email. And the telegram went, "Arriving Sunday, married Wednesday. Love, Phil." Things began to fly in Melbourne at that stage. My father was down at Hardy's buying a ring, with Pat, of course. She and her family were making hurried preparations for a wedding, which was pretty well attended under all the circumstances. She had to borrow a bridal gown from one of her friends. a father who was a general practitioner called in a few of his favours and got sufficient chooks and grog to make the evening a worthwhile one. And we went down to the Peninsula Country Golf Club at Frankston for 3 or 4 days, played golf. My golf advanced to such a stage as I got a 4 at the last on the last round we played. We had great fun.
Life going on swiftly, things having to happen in a hurry, I get the impression, during wartime.
Yeah, but they did. Pat then decided she'd become a camp follower, and she sent me a telegram by way of repayment, I suppose. Arriving in Tenterfield Railway Station, 10-6, such and such a date. And of course, I'd just issued orders that there would be no camp followers around the place because they got in the way, really. Anyway, there she was, and there she stayed for a few weeks until I told her that the battalion had gone into action. And she decided that perhaps she would have then returned to Melbourne, which she did. They're very happy days.
How was the war seen to be going around this time? After Shaggy Ridge, February, April, and then into June, where the 6th of June, the Allies invade Normandy. What do you recall of that occasion, the importance of that?
Well, during 1944, things started to move everywhere, both in the Pacific and, of course, in Europe. And it seemed as though we were getting the upper hand, but much fighting remained to be done. However, the Normandy invasion was a great move in that direction and had a constant attention so far as you could by way of newspaper reports and the wireless and so on. And of course the internal reports that we got from time to time from intelligence. We followed it keenly, but we were also wondering what our role was going to be in winding up the Japs, whether we'd be required to land at Tokyo, finally, crossed our minds. But with ever-increasing dismay, we found as 1944 went through that we were not going to be employed by the Americans in a direct role.
How did that...
In the Philippines.
How did that make you feel?
Oh, we felt that we'd been not being used to the full, our full potential, that we deserved a place in the final result, if that was to be the final result. However, we were professional soldiers at that time, although we were, of course, citizens and volunteers, essentially. We looked at it professionally, and if there were Japs around, they had to be dealt with, and if that was our role, we had to do it. There was some debate in some quarters as to whether the 1945 operations were justified, Balikpapan for our part in Borneo. But there was never a murmur in my battalion.
Looking back on those events, how do you see the situation now?
Same way. No different. I was proud of my battalion because before we went into battle, before we left Moratai to where we were staged to get on small landing craft to make the journey to Balik, of a few days. We had sand tables out and every man knew what his job was. Every man took an intelligent interest in what he had to do. Time spent in reconnaissance was well taken up on this occasion.
Tell us about what was to go on.
Well, each company came through the same table, and I talked to them about it, and the adjutant talked about it, and the intelligence officer talked about it. Questions were asked and answers given. The result being that everyone had confidence about what they were going to do and a full understanding of why they were doing it. Nobody murmured anything to the contrary, although I invited them all to have their say. But they accepted it as a professional job to do, and they did it bloody well. In fact, at Balloch, after we had landed, our job was to go eastwards up the coastal highway to Sepangang, an airfield, and Mangar, an airfield. We occupied Sepangang without opposition. The moment we hit Mangar, we were fired upon by coastal defence guns in the hills to the left of the airfield. Big things had boomed away, and on the airfield in the Mangar River, which is on the bottom end of the airstrip, there was a big control tower. And up this control tower climbed a fellow called Thorpe, young captain. He was a forward observation officer for the Navy. He was an architect, soon to be a leading architect in Sydney. He stopped up there for 4 days, each time that they fired at this control tower. A bit of it would go and lurch, but he still kept there. And he did a wonderful job directing the United States cruiser Eaton, I think it was, onto the targets. During 5 days of preparation at that spot, because we couldn't just take them by attack, we would have been decimated, we had to get rid of these guns. And for the first time we were able to use all the weaponry at our command. We had plenty of ammunition. We had time. We were able to learn the first lessons that we learnt about warfare when we went into Bakopanerol in 1940. First there was bombardment by aeroplanes over a period of 5 days. Then the cruisers out at sea, the United States Navy out at sea, our own artillery, the 2nd 5th Field Regiment, in support, some anti-tank guns, which we used to fire directly at the opening of the guns, which had been detected by the company, D Company, which is hard up against these guns. Meanwhile, the rest of the battalion was in various spots around the airfield. Battalion headquarters was in the creek at the river at the control tower. Now and again, the coastal gun would fire at us, and we did suffer a couple of casualties at the time. CO of the 2nd Field Regiment, 5th Field Regiment, he was wounded. He was standing nearby me. My batman, who was making a cup of tea, almost about to hand me a cup of tea, he was hit by a shrapnel burst. That caused a little unhappiness at the time, but all of us were under some pressure, and yet having time to work. Finally, I decided that it was time to go, and go we went. The position was taken, and some prisoners were taken. And soon after that, This would be the 6th of July when this position was taken. Soon after that, rumours started to circulate that the war was nearing an end. We didn't know why it was going to end. But it transpired the dropping of the bomb, and August the 15th arrived when all hostilities ceased.
What were some of the major points that you can recall of 1945 that gave you confidence in relation to the situation and how it was improving?
Firstly, in Europe, the situation with the Germans was that they were, despite some successful counterattacks, they were gradually being beaten. And as May came along, of course, they signed their capitulation. We were being continually successful against the Japanese, despite their suicide bombers. The one that crashed against the bridge, for example, of the Australian, was it? HMAS Australia? Anyway, one of our biggest ships. That caused some sort of consternation that perhaps we would be up against a foolhardy enemy again.
What do you recall of VE Day? Where were you when that took place?
I was commanding the battalion at the Manga Air Fairfield, preparing to send out patrols further along to the east.
What did it mean for you at this point? And was it possible for you to celebrate at all?
We got orders of the day received from the headquarters, brigade and division. Church services were held. We persisted with patrolling, having in mind our experience in Syria with the French, in case the Japanese hadn't got through or were unwilling to obey their command. Troops themselves were relaxed. They talked about what had gone on over the previous years. The five-year men, the men who had served for 5 years in overseas, knew that they were due for earmarked for repatriation. Growing excitement occurred in their ranks. We received a batch of Japanese prisoners which we were obliged to put under lock and key in makeshift prison area on the airstrip. We were busy, all the time thinking of old comrades who had died, all the time thinking what might have been.
What sort of condition were the Japanese in at this point, given that you'd taken prisoners?
Oh, just like any beaten, fervent person that waged a war well, but finally knew the game was up. A bit despondent. We also received at the same time a group of our own prisoners who had been returned from captivity. We were asked to put them up briefly. There's one fellow that I was been at school with. He suffered badly at the hands of the Japanese in prison. And he went up to the wire and started to shake it and visibly and physically shout at the Japanese, which if he'd got support from his own group of prisoners and the Japanese took it to heart, we might have had an ugly situation on our hand. But I got my second in command to take this fellow away. I said, take him into the mess and give him a drink, quieten him down. And anyway, that passed over. But it was quite a few moments of anxiety.
And what was the general feeling toward the Japanese, given your experiences?
It was surprising, really. There was no bitterness evident, although there must have been some stored up somewhere. But there were no encounters with them. They disregarded as, there for the grace of God goes you.
What then of your future role? You mentioned earlier that you thought there was a possibility of you going to Tokyo, to Japan.
Well, that was evident that we were not doing that long before we commenced the Belly Pap campaign.
Did you feel that the Japanese would literally resist to the last, wherever they were?
Yes. No reason to think otherwise. They were fanatics, you know.
The fact that they had this, the zeal that they had in relation to the emperor, was that something that was a benefit to them, do you think, in relation to looking at the way the Australians, the British fought? Not quite cricket and all that?
They had this fanatical obedience to come right or wrong. And nothing can happen if you obey the emperor, as I understood it. That must be a strong point in their own favour, within their own ranks, that they could, so long as they were obeying the emperor, all was right. Which fed, of course, their fanatical zeal. They were a race to be reckoned with. Couldn't take them lightly.
So as things progressed from VE Day, what do you recall from May the 8th, 45, until the time that you yourselves would be?
Well, we knew that we were going to have another job to do, and it turned out to be Balikpapan, which required us to have an amphibious operation, which was the first amphibious operation undertaken by Australian troops in World War II. So therefore we had a period at Trinity Beach off Cairns, where British ships used in the invasion in Normandy came out to help train us. That was quite an experience, talking to the captain of the ship, who told us at first hand what his experiences were in the landing in Europe. Quite an interesting fellow.
What do you recall of some of the major points he may have made?
Planning, detail, everything looked after, nothing left to chance, rehearsals. Catering for every possible situation, some which are impossible. That was quite a good period, that. Learning a new trade from experienced people. The British crew of this, forget the name of the ship now. Courteous and understanding, were good instructors. After the Balikpapan campaign, the 5-year men were marched off to go back to Australia. We got a few reinforcements, and finally we received orders to go to the Celebes. We got on Corvette at Balloch made the short journey across to the Celebes.
You mentioned earlier on Curtin. He was to die on the 5th of July. Do you recall that occasion and the effect that that had in relation to yourself and the men?
Curtin had turned out to be a fine Prime Minister. Whatever your political beliefs might have been, he was exactly that. And we had a particular reason to thank him, of course, when he brought us back from the Middle East and stood up to Churchill. Having experienced the Middle East and also the Southwest Pacific area, we understood his statement when he said our future lay with America rather than the British Empire. We understood that. And we admired his courage for having said it. We thank God for his courage in standing up to Churchill. Great though Churchill was. We admired his pragmatism. We were sorry to see him go.
So late in the piece?
Yep, so near to the end, as it turned out. As in all governments, what was under him wasn't crash hot. Ford was not up to the job. But things worked out.
You mentioned you were off to the Celebes.
An interesting thing took place just before we moved to the Celebes. The command in the Southwest Pacific area changed from the Americans to the British. There's a realignment of command. And there was a dinner for senior officers of the Dutch and Allied forces in the Balikpapan area, and a brigade parade for Mountbatten, who had taken over command of the Southeast Asia area. It so happened that I was sitting next to Mountbatten at dinner. And I was surprised at the detail with which he knew what we'd been up to in the previous years. He knew almost exactly what the battalion had done, both in the Middle East and at home. He talked about the founding of the George Cross. I was surprised to hear him say, you know, I said to George, that's George the Sixth, we should have something to for Malta and so on. He went on in this family way of talking about the king, which, you know, was astonished us. At the brigade parade, he got up to talk after his inspection. He was on a dais. And I saw him go like this. All of a sudden I was overrun by troops. He wanted them around the dais so he could speak to them man to man almost. A thing I'd never seen done. Although it almost happened in an involuntary way with Blamey earlier on. Such was the man. He was a man's man. He was a good fellow, briefly, as I saw him. Anyway, back to the Celebes. We arrived and we marched through the town with the band playing Waltzing Matilda. They took the area of the governor of the province. Brigadier Chilton was in command of the brigade. There was 27 there and the 16th. And we were assigned to an area called Pari Pari, 90 miles north of Makassar, the capital. There we had two jobs to do, to supervise the gathering of the 2nd Japanese Army, not behind bars, not behind wire, just in an area. designated by markers. They were commanded by a general called General Tsushima. We used to, after having given him instructions, we used to go up there. It was a journey of about an hour, I suppose, to get to where they were, from our headquarters at Pari Pari. I used to go up and have a chat with him from time to time. I felt that I had his confidence and I had his. We had very little trouble with them.